From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nathaniel Philbrick knows he's not exactly objective when he talks about the novel Moby Dick. He did, after all, write a bestseller about the real-life nautical disaster that inspired the book. He does live on Nantucket, the holy ground for Moby Dick. And his parents did name him for Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville's friend and muse for the book. So he cops to all of that. Still, he says Moby Dick deserves to be called our American Bible, and he's determined to get you to read it. Today in the program, Philbrick is joining us to make his case. He says the more the country changes, the more relevant Moby Dick seems to be. And by reading it, we'll come to know the country. Contained in its pages, he says, is nothing less than the genetic code of America. So, why read Moby Dick? After the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Nathaniel Philbrick confesses his prejudices about the novel Moby Dick. He did write, of course, a bestseller about the real-life nautical disaster that inspired the book. His parents did name him for Nathaniel Hawthorne, Herman Melville's friend and muse for the book. And he lives on Nantucket, which is, of course, the holy ground for Moby Dick. Still, he says the novel deserves to be called our American Bible, and he is determined to get you to read it. Today in the program, Nathaniel Philbrick is joining us to make his case. He says the more the country changes, the more relevant Moby Dick seems to be. By reading it, he says, we'll come to know the country. The book is called Why Read Moby Dick? And today in the program, as I said, we're talking about it. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of 6 history books, including In the Heart of the Sea, which won the National Book Award for nonfiction. Most recently, he's the author of The Last Stand, about Custer and Sitting Bull. He's also written and edited a number of sailing books, and he's joining us today from Nantucket. That's where he lives, from a studio there at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation. And Nathaniel Philbrick, welcome back. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Okay, so I wanted to start with, when did you first read Moby Dick?
Like a lot of people, I first encountered it in high school. I was a senior at Taylor Alderdice High School in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that maritime capital of the universe. And it was an AP English course. And my father is now a retired English professor who regularly taught Moby Dick. And so all growing up, I was told over and over again by my father about what a great novel it was. So by the time I was approaching 18, the last thing I wanted to do was read Moby Dick, and along with most of my classmates, I'll add. But amazingly enough, I had to read it to graduate. And when I did read it, the voice of Ishmael just immediately captivated me. And from ever since, it's been my favorite book.
But why the voice of Ishmael? Is it you related to him in some way?
Yeah, you know, it's the voice of Ishmael is a very flexible voice. It changes throughout the novel. But in the beginning, I just found it like, you know, the catcher in the rye, in the way that he just said, you know, he has a dark, drizzly November of his soul. And, you know, I think any teenager full of angst can relate to that. And also very early on in that first chapter, you know, it begins with Call Me Ishmael, which is just the greatest
That's the hook, right?
Opening. Yeah, that's the hook. Yeah. But he describes the city of New York on a Sunday afternoon, where everyone who's been pent up in lath and plaster inside has gone down to the Battery and looking out at the river and the harbor and the ocean beyond, looking for the ungraspable phantom of life. And here I was, a teenager in Pittsburgh who was very interested in sailing. And it just spoke to me with a power that I just had to keep going.
So Moby Dick is, of course, well known, but as you put it in the book, of the American classics, it's probably the most reluctantly read. And I suppose it's obvious. It's really big, and it can be dense, and it goes off on these seemingly, you know, endless tangents. But is there something more to it? Why is it so difficult, at least to grasp it and read at first, you figure?
Well, I think, you know, it partly suffers from the fact that the plot is so well known. And so everyone knows about Ahab. Everyone knows about the white whale. And if you're like many people and you read books for plot, becomes very frustrating because you do not meet Ahab until about a third of the way into the book. There are all these little chapters that go off in directions that seem to have nothing to do with the plot. And if you're not patient, you may begin to wonder, what is this really about? And you know, it can be frustrating, I think. And I mean, that's what's part of the great attraction of the novel, I think, is it's always defying expectations. It's always full of surprises. And if you're patient enough, the payoff is immense. But I think it is such a big and intimidating book, potentially, that many people just have a hard time getting beyond beyond that initial impression.
You say that if the book possibly falls by the wayside, that we will have lost the book that deserves to be called the American Bible. Are you worried about that, that the book is falling by the wayside, that it will really fall by the wayside?
You know, I think what's a great work of literature will never fall by the wayside because it's just so good, people will always come to it.
Sure.
However, you know, I think as the way we read changes, the way our society changes, the increasingly short attention span we all seem to have, I think there is a potential threat out there, and you know, it's a long and demanding book, and we all have busy lives. But part of the reason why I felt compelled to write Why Read Moby Dick is I think that, you know, if I just wanted to people say, wait, get beyond those first initial negative impressions, if you have that, and give it a try.
I want to ask you about your favorite part of Moby Dick. It's how you begin the book, really. And it's with a reference that Melville makes to a very specific moment in time.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted you to talk about that particular moment, if you would, because you say whenever you come upon this part in the book, and you've read the book, I don't know, 12, 13 times? No, more than that. How many times now?
About a dozen times. I've really lost track.
Right? But every time you come upon this part of the book, you say, you feel like I'm with Herman Melville and as he's creating this thing.
Well, you know, it's what I love about this part of the book. It's a little chapter called The Fountain. It's number chapter 85. And in it, Melville is talking about how for thousands, millions of years, whales have been mystifying the air with their spouts.
Yeah.
And in talking about for how long, up until this present moment, and then he does a remarkable thing. He pulls back the curtain. I always find myself thinking of the Wizard of Oz, you know, when he pulls back the curtain. And he says, and he gives you the exact time at which he is writing. And he says, 15 and a quarter minutes past 1 o'clock p.m. of the 16th day of December, A.D. 1850. And you just know he's taking his watch, he's looking at it and writing that down. And for me, it's like, wow, I'm there with him at that very moment where he is creating this book. And it's wonderfully modern. It just, it suddenly makes Melville an author as and a person, as well as, you know, it almost personalizes this great work of art. So for me, it's like, wow. You know, I'm there with him, and you know, it's a very modern kind of thing, and I think that's part of the attraction of Moby Dick in subsequent generations has been that he wrote a basically postmodern novel in the 19th century.
Well, the idea that it's so personal is an important part of your book, of your reading of Melville, and I'm interested in how. Just how personal it was, how many of the images and the symbols were taken from Melville's life and the way he thought. And you talk about, later on in the book, you talk about how a writer has to find this balance in what you describe as that tension between the active and passive engagement. And you talk about that a writer has to be engaged in the story, that for it to be truly persuasive, for it to work, and clearly for you and for so many others, Moby Dick works. But for that to happen, you can't just, as you say, sit back like God and cast judgment. You have to, what, Nathaniel Philbrook, put yourself in there as well.
Yeah, and I think that's really what makes a work something more than just pretty words, you know, on a page. And, yeah. You know, there are so many wonderfully written works of literature that leave me cold, and they don't affect me in a personal way. And I think that, you know, that is a great writer potentially, but somehow the craft has gotten in the way of transmitting that human sense of being a part of the world. And with Moby Dick, you know, it's the level of the prose is incredible, but there's always a sense of a person in there, of someone who is frightened, perplexed, angry, prideful at times, but it's there. And so for me, reading this book, it is a very personal process. And part of that is Melville has found a way, he has projected himself into this novel, but a way in which here we are, 160-some years afterwards, so many of us are able to respond to it in a very immediate way. And you know, that for me, you know, yes, it's about Ahab and the white whale, but there are these little microclimates within the novel that are very personal and are surprising, and they come like gifts. And so I encourage anyone who is, you know, if you're in the middle of the book or you're thinking about the book and you get frustrated about where is this going, you'll stumble upon one of these gems at the most unexpected times.
Well, you talk about how the book was really ignored in Melville's lifetime, but you mentioned that, for example, later into the 20th century, in the 1920s, for example, you talk about how these writers saw it as this incredibly experimental piece of work and innovative. And as one writer put it, they saw it as this test to prove whether a person's response to literature was genuine. It seemed to resonate so authentically to writers that they thought your response to Moby Dick is the test, which is really interesting.
It is really interesting, particularly since, you know, it's the 1920s, decades after, you know, almost approaching a century after the book was written.
Right.
And yet when the book came out in the 1850s, it dropped to the bottom with barely a sound. People really didn't know what to make of it. And I my own personal theory is that it took the First World War to really change how humanity saw the world and itself. You know, after that war, much of the romance in life, the beliefs everyone held, were now being questioned, and structures, literary, societal, that people had taken for granted, were beginning to change and just fall to pieces or be transformed. And I think people, we began to catch up to Melville, out of the doubt and fear, really, created at the beginning of the 20th century, we were able to sort of finally catch up to where Melville had been with the Civil War looming in the collective consciousness of his time.
Well, that's and what so, this book is about. I mean, that's what I think is so interesting. Of course, that makes sense that in the 20s, in the wake of that disastrous, you know, world war, that it would that Moby Dick would seem like something written in the moment, because, as you say contained in the pages of Moby Dick is the genetic code of America. And what you're talking about here, of course, slavery is in here, a response to that, Western expansion, but of course the great, as you say, great cataclysm to come, which is the Civil War. That's the thing that's on his mind, and that's the, in many ways, that sort of existential threat that Ishmael, that Ahab, that they're working through in the book in many ways.
Yeah. And the fact that he wrote it at a time where the war wasn't there yet, but it was coming.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, an impending catastrophe rather than being in the midst of it. That's what makes it all the more excruciating. And if you look at Moby Dick, we don't see the white whale to the final three chapters.
Right.
Everything is delayed to the very end, and you're living in this intense sense of foreboding. and the powerlessness everyone feels, even Ahab feels, even though it's his quest that is being enacted, is just so powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reason why it was unappreciated in its time. Most people were not willing yet to face what was ahead for the country. It was you looked at the headlines and things like that with the Fugitive Slave Act creating all sorts of issues and all that. But you know, typically, as we all live in this world, it's the day to day that occupies us, and the cataclysm really is kept at an arm's length until it's upon us. And yet, Melville felt it. And I think after World War I, as I said earlier, we had begun to sort of get into that frame of mind. And I think that's why today, when something really bad happens or is about to happen, whether it's, you know, the oil spill or a tsunami or whatever, or a revolution, those kinds of things make this novel newly relevant, mm-hmm. because Melville has somehow found a way to put in there what it feels like to have your world changing underneath your feet.
It's such an American story. I mean, the Pequod becomes this hearse. But as Ahab makes clear, it's not just any hearse. It's an American hearse. I mean, in those final moments, he cries out. He calls the ship a hearse. And he says its wood could only be American. And I don't think I had understand that until you put it in that context.
Yeah, I mean, it's all there. And I'm now working on a book about the American Revolution, and it's given me just recently a whole new understanding of what is in Moby Dick. Yeah. Because, you know, that what led to a revolution, it was not this sort of, you know, wonderfully ideological search for liberty. It was full of blood and passion, and it was terribly disturbing and disruptive. And there was a lot of unresolved issues, which would not be resolved if they ever were, by the Civil War. And so Melville's got that all in there, and it's very American. And the other thing is, Melville had for a guy who was only 31 when he wrote this, had quite an experience. Not only had he sailed around the world as a whaleman, but before he headed out for that, he had taken a Western tour and gotten out to Illinois and the Mississippi River and seen what was then the West. And all of those details, those kinds of things are in Moby Dick. You know, you're on a sea voyage, but through metaphor and simile, he's always pulling you back into the interior of this new nation. And so this book is as American as you can possibly be.
We should explain. You mentioned this kind of astounded me. I didn't realize he was so young. He's 31, and you talk about his circumstance at the time. I mean, it seems really impulsive. I mean, he moves his family from New York City to Western Massachusetts, basically to be near his literary idol, Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Yeah,
he's got this growing family. He's had some early success, but you know, he's worried about his prospects in the future. Why was being near Nathaniel Hawthorne so important, do you figure?
Yeah, I mean, it's really kind of extraordinary. You know, we being an author, professional author today is, you know, something that happens regularly. But in 1850, there was only a handful of people who even dared think about supporting themselves by writing. And Melville had an earlier successful book. And was now trying to keep it going, even though each book was not doing as well as the first book, Typee. And Melville's on vacation in August of 1850 in the Berkshires, where his family his uncle had had a home, and he meets Nathaniel Hawthorne. And Hawthorne had just come out with The Scarlet Letter, right, a bestseller, and Melville, after meeting him, read a book of his short stories and was just blown away by the power of darkness. And at this point, it seems as if Melville, we know he had already started work on a novel about whaling, and by all indications was pretty much done with a first draft. But when he meets Hawthorne,
it changes.
Everything changes.
Yeah.
And he tells his family, we're going to move from New York and we're going to move to the Berkshires, where Hawthorne is living. And we're going to buy a house, and that's where we're going to live. And so, you know, he moves everything in a matter of months. By that fall, he's living in the Berkshires, and he's completely reinvented his novel. He and the character of Ahab seems to have been inspired by Hawthorne. And so that, I think that lends to kind of the spontaneous nature of Moby Dick. He's torn this novel, pre-existing novel, apart and building something new on its foundations. And it gives the novel a wonderful slapdash air about it. You know, you can see the timbers inside the house, and off he goes. And so he goes into this 9-month intense process of writing. Reconceives the novel. Every now and then he visits Hawthorne. He writes a series of amazing letters to Hawthorne in which they're full of all the passion and imagery of the novel. And in this 9-month period, he creates this wonderful masterwork.
Well, you talk about how once he sits down at his desk in the morning, you talk about how he was then literally consumed by the story. I mean, he goes into this kind of mesmerized condition. His family can't get him to come to lunch. Yeah. Is he going maybe this is sort of sounds flippant, but is he going crazy? I mean, what's going on with them?
Well, that's exactly what his family feared.
Sure.
And his mother in particular. And I mean, he was in a zone. I mean, as you alluded to, he'd go up there and it was great. If you're in Pittsfield, the Melville's house is now a wonderful museum, and you can go into his study on the second floor and see you know, where it all happened. But he would go up there in the morning and often not have much lunch, if anything, and come down late in the afternoon and early evening and just sort of hang out in a mesmeric state, he describes it, and then keep going. And his eyes had always bothered him. But with this novel, they began to hurt him so badly that he had a hard time seeing. And in a subsequent novel that he wrote, Pierre, he describes that process, and whereby, you know, he's squinting. He can barely see the words he's writing on the page, and yet nothing can stop him. I think there's Ahab, there's a lot of autobiography in Ahab, in that relentless quest, and I think it's almost a metaphor for the creative process by which that novel was happening.
Well, you know, one thing that I found interesting is, in the beginning of the book, before he gets to the story itself, you know, there's that language about the etymology, and then there are the extracts,
right,
section. And now this comes from Melville, right? I mean,
yeah.
So this is him just kind of unloading his mind. You can tell he's read everything he can get his hands on. And it's almost like he's got napkins and, you know, tea bags and all
right.
kinds of things where he's just, this is what I found interesting. This is what I found interesting. This is what I found interesting. And there are pages and pages of it.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, we all think it begins with Call Me Ishmael. But a matter of fact, there's something like 20 pages of quotes and passages about whales. And, you know, it's a audacious way to begin a book.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't care if the reader is with him from the beginning or not.
Right.
He is just so into this topic that, and, you know, he has internalized everything there is about whaling. And it's not just about whaling. It means every word means something more. And so he just lays it out there. And it's a fascinating process to read the extracts and to sort of see what each quote might mean in the context of the novel to come. I don't think many people have the gumption to wade through a lot of those quotes. But it is, you know, it just lends itself to showing you that, you know, Melville was somehow, with this kinship with Hawthorne, by, you know, moving into the Berkshires, he, you know, the market be damned, he was in his own zone. And he enjoyed a tremendous freedom within it, and he just let her rip. He would, you know, pay the consequences in terms of the marketplace. But ultimately, I think, you know, it's borne him out.
Historian Nathaniel Philbrick is with us. His book is called Why Read Moby Dick? You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Nathaniel Philbrick about his book, which kind of explains exactly what the book is about as well, the title anyway, Why Read Moby Dick? And let's take a call from Craig, who's joining us in Salt Lake. Craig, sorry for the wait. Welcome.
No problem. Just a comment. I saw Mr. Philbrick's book at Barnes & Noble a couple of weeks ago, and it reminded me when I first read Moby Dick 30 years ago in college. And there was one chapter that just blew me away as a 22-year-old. And in all of these 30 years, I haven't picked up that book again, but I will never forget the number of the chapter and the title. It was chapter 42, The Whiteness of the Whale. And It was this philosophical masterpiece of where Melville just talks about white and black and opposites and good and evil, and he equates whiteness with blindness and fog and dead fish and corpses, and he just turns the whole concept of whiteness that is traditionally associated with good and pure and turns it on its head. And it was just a stunning, stunning philosophical piece, and I have never in all of these years forgotten that one chapter. And just seeing your book in the store, it's just motivated me. I'm looking forward to reading it again after all these years, and I'll just hear your comments offline. Thanks.
Thanks, Craig.
Well, Craig, you put your finger on, I have a hard time saying what's my favorite part of Moby Dick, but that chapter about whiteness is one of the great, not only rhetorical performances, but as you were saying, philosophical. It goes to places that are just amazing, and it's great to know that that's stayed with you, because that is a chapter that will haunt your dreams very much so, and that's what Ishmael is feeling. It's the whiteness of the whale that is the really terrifying thing for him, and it speaks to, I think, the terror we all feel in the face of the unknown. And Ahab's approach to all this is to kill that darn whale and get beyond it. Ishmael is reserving judgment, but I think it just gets at that fear of annihilation we all have.
Craig, glad you called. Thanks very much. So there's the story you tell about Herman Melville in 1841. He goes to sea. And of course, that was very influential in the book that he would eventually write. He heard the story of the Essex, which you know your fair share about, that Nantucket whale ship that was brought down by this great sperm whale. And he came to meet Owen Chase, who tells him, lends him his father's book, tells him the story, of course, of the Essex. But that makes sense, of course. But what's really interesting, and I hadn't realized, is Melville after this, so he's got this on his mind, and then he deserts the ship he's on.
Yeah.
On one of the Marquesas Islands to live among the natives. And this folds into that experience as well. He fictionalizes the story, of course, and Ishmael, when confronted with this this tattooed cannibal, comes to the conclusion that, and I guess I'm sensing slavery there in the backdrop of all of this, but that this man is a human being just like I am.
Yeah, yeah. It's one of those insights that I think is still astonishing today, and he makes it in the middle of the 19th century.
Yeah.
We are in a we revel now in the multicultural nature of our society and the increasingly global world we live in. That wasn't the way it was in the 19th century. Other cultures were to be feared, and in the case of the Essex disaster, the survivors of the Essex were so fearful of cannibals in the Marquesas that they rowed their boats 3,000 miles to the coast of South America. Yeah. And the great irony is that most of them died and were forced to those that survived on survival cannibalism.
Right.
And Melville, having read this story, does the opposite of the Essex survivors. Instead of staying away from the native peoples, he jumped ship and joined them. And it was the experience that you could argue from which all his books, and particularly Moby Dick, would come. And so that when Ishmael literally embraces Queequeg, you know, it comes from a very personal place for Melville. And it's a personal place that I think we can all relate to now in the 21st century, as, you know, we're all part of the, we can, you know, we have no choice but to recognize that we're all in this together.
Mm. Ishmael, you point out, is, you know, he's this deckhand. We come to find out, you know, who he is later, of course. He's this kind of mysterious figure in a lot of ways. But he isn't just doing this job for money. I mean, you point out that that he's there in pursuit of this sort of platonic ideal. And on some level, he's looking to, and this is important when you think about Melville, he's looking to feel alive almost.
Yeah, I mean, this is, he is not an ordinary seaman. You know, he is fascinated by the idea of the white whale itself. Mm-hmm. You know, it is a truly platonic, idealistic quest that he is on, and in many ways, it's the opposite end of the of Ahab's quest. You know, Ahab wants to get this white whale and kill it, and that will solve all the problems of his universe. Ishmael is in pursuit of the concept of it, which is very interesting. And you know, and I think that gets to sort of the dual nature of Moby Dick. It is about ideas in a very important way, and yet it's always rooted to the here and now.
Yeah.
There is a bedrock of reality that's always there. And I mean, that is the toughest tightrope act there is to, you know, take the real world and project a sense of reality while showing that there are meanings attached to this world that go beyond anything in the here and now. And, you know, it's so easy to lose, to go one way or the other and lose people. And, you know, that, and, you know, on occasion you can accuse Melville of doing that. But the fact of the matter is he has created a fiction that is reaches to the stars, but is grounded on the realities of this, the here and now of this world.
Well, you're really adamant about this in the book, because I think, and I think in some ways this may explain why some people are reluctant with Moby Dick, that the whale itself is a symbol, is this specter or something like that. But you make this point near the end of the book, as Ahab makes his last stand, of course, that the white whale is not a symbol. He is as real as you or I, and that's very important for you.
It's for me, I think if you – so many people come to the book trying to figure out what the white whale represents.
Yeah.
And I think that is completely undersells the book and is kind of an insult, really, to Melville as a novelist. Yes, you can let the symbolic chips fall as they may, but the fact of the matter is those last three chapters of Moby Dick are some of the great action writing of all time. And Melville it's not a symbol he's writing about there. He knows whales. He's read about them. This is a whale with a very specific identity and personality. And this is really happening time and time again in Moby Dick. He tells you, he says, look, you know, it's easy to see this as an allegory, but it's not. It's not. This really happened. And if you can, if you read the book without appreciating that, you're really doing yourself a disfavor, because read it for what it is. It's about a big white whale,
a really
scary one. And you know, you can see it as a symbol, but I implore you to enjoy the book as just a tremendous adventure story, action story as well.
So I wanted, Nathaniel Philbrick, to have you, if you didn't mind, take us through some of the series of scenes where Melville, toward the end of the book, gives us this, of course, very real sense of what it's like to become the target of an immense whale. In chapter 133 of Moby Dick, you write about these three encounters. And this first the first one comes from a distance, which it's such a lovely moment in some ways. But again, gives you a sense that this is a real beast, of course, under that water, where Moby Dick is moving across the surface. Could you talk about that moment?
Yeah, well, I mean, and this is where I'm just in absolute awe of Melville's ability to as just the nuts and bolts of being a fiction writer. I mean, he uses perspective in an incredibly illuminating way. I mean, we don't just see the whale. We see the whale at a distance. And so that allows him to work at it from the edges in a way. And builds tension, and then the whale dives, yeah. And then we're looking down into the aquamarine void, and you see this little white object in the deep distance, mm-hmm. And it's like a little weasel. He describes
it
as,
yeah.
And you can just see it coming at you in 3D, and then bang, this huge battle scarred head erupts from the depths, and then. There it is.
Yeah. Marbleized body is how he describes it.
Marbleized body.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so it's, the pacing of it is wonderful. We were talking earlier about a writer writing from a distance and being engaged in his material. And right there, you have Melville combining both in a wonderful way, where we begin at a distance and then we are just sucked in in such terrifying immediacy that this whale literally explodes and we're in the middle of it.
Well, and then we have to wait. Yeah. You know, there's the explosion, the arch, and then he makes us wait for the attack.
Yeah. Yeah, and always he's doing that. He's always using it to build tension. And it's interesting when you wait, he's sneaking in stuff all the time about what other characters are doing, about evoking things around you, and it's just the pacing of it is very interesting.
I want to ask you about the image that Melville uses, and it comes on day two of this encounter with the whale, and Moby Dick has bashed these two whale boats. Mm-hmm. And Melville describes it this way. He says, "The odorous cedar chips of the wrecks danced round and round like the grated nutmeg in a swiftly stirred bowl of punch," which is – that's terrific anyway, but it's really personal. Because as you write about this, he's conveying what his sense of the disintegration of his own talent.
Yeah, because in a letter that exists that he wrote to Hawthorne, just at the time that he is, just before really he begins working on these chapters, he describes his own talent as being ground down like nutmeg, And then to have him write this, you begin to realize, wow, this is much more than just a lovely and evocative image. This is personal. I mean, he's in there on all levels. And that's one of the reasons why I urge anyone who is reading Moby Dick or contemplating it to at some point read his letters to Hawthorne as well. Because the interplay between the images that he's projecting in the book and the images that are just bubbling forth in his letters to Hawthorne are very subtle and very personal.
You talk about how Herman Melville, now mind you, he's a 31, 32-year-old man, and he lives a long life after this. For that time, a pretty decent life, but he had a hard time shaking the Ahab out of him, is how you put it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, can you imagine it? He writes what he had to know in his soul was a masterpiece. Yeah. Hawthorne liked it. In fact, it's dedicated to Hawthorne, right. And that meant a huge amount to him. But that was about it. He would live for another 40 years, and his career would reach the point that he'd have to basically give up being a professional writer and move back to New York and become a customs official. He had to live with that disappointment. And what I find, and I go into in the book, is I think that personal story provides an important context to the novel, because he continued with great dignity and continued writing. And even though it didn't have much of an audience, he created some great literature in the aftermath of Moby Dick.
Well, there's this story that it's a little surprising that he hadn't really gone to Nantucket. He created a Nantucket from his mind. But about a year after that, he goes with his, I think it was with his father-in-law to Nantucket. And being there, you write, seems to have changed his perspective in a kind of important way. I mean, he meets this man, this Captain George Pollard, and was really taken by how different Pollard was from Ahab. Pollard is this god. I mean, Ahab is this godlike figure.
Mm-hmm.
Pollard is as unassuming as there is, and he's really impressed with that.
Yeah, well, you know, it's amazing. The year after writing Moby Dick, he goes for the first time to the holy ground of Moby Dick, Nantucket. You can't make this stuff up. And there he meets Captain Pollard, captain of the whale ship that had been rammed and sunk, the Essex.
Right.
And Pollard would lose his second ship soon after that, and become a kind of outcast. He was a night watchman and a nobody to the islanders, Melville writes. But to me, one of the most impressive men I have ever met. And I think the example of Pollard, who, despite having the worst possible fate happened to him, continued on with great dignity, and was he was a nobody, but he was respected in the community. I think that really impacted Melville. And what you see is, during that experience on Nantucket, he would write Hawthorne, who by this time had sort of fled the Berkshires and was living in the Concord area. He writes him a letter and says, I've heard this story about a woman on Nantucket who marries a whaler, who has his child. He goes off on a voyage and doesn't come back for 17 years.
Yeah.
This story of abandonment, you know, which is so evocative, what he must have felt when it came to his literary audience, to his mentor Hawthorne, all of this. And he offers Hawthorne this story. And Hawthorne says, no, you should write it. Melville then writes a novel that seems to have been inspired by this Nantucket story called The Isle of the Cross, but he would never publish it. And the manuscript is lost. We don't know what happened to it.
I want to ask you, finally, you write about the reason you read Moby Dick. And it's in many ways for all kinds of different reasons. But there's a part of this mixture of skepticism and hope that you see in Herman Melville. He travels to Liverpool, Herman Melville, to visit Nathaniel Hawthorne, who's there. I mean, at some point they go on this walk. And I wanted you to read what Hawthorne wrote about that experience, because it seems to reveal kind of this tension that impressed Hawthorne, or interested him anyway, and seems to interest you, that tension between being a believer and a skeptic.
Yeah, and I think Hawthorne knew Melville very well, after that year, and really respected him, and felt very sad for him in the years after Moby Dick, and so they would have this talk, and afterwards Hawthorne would record in his journal, "Melville, as he always does, began to reason of providence and futurity, and of everything that lies beyond human ken, and informed me that he had pretty much made up his mind to be annihilated. But still he does not seem to rest in that anticipation, and I think will never rest until he gets hold of a definite belief. It is strange how he persists, and has persisted ever since I knew him, and probably long before, in wandering to and fro over these deserts, as dismal and monotonous as the sandhills amid which we were sitting. He can neither believe nor be comfortable in his unbelief, and he is too honest and courageous not to try to do one or the other. If he were a religious man, he would be one of the most truly religious and reverential. He has a very high and noble nature, and better worth immortality than most of us. Yeah, and I think that's it.
Yeah,
and Melville, that would be Melville for the next 35 years.
Less than a minute left. Let me ask you this finally. Obviously, you want people to read it. How do you recommend they get into it? I think you say spend some time, but do we need to ease into it? How do you say the best way to start?
Yeah, the first thing is I think it's a book. If you the older you are, almost the better in terms of bringing life experience to it. And I think it's a very personal thing. I find that the fact that it's a bunch of short chapters, it's broken up in so many chapters, is actually helpful given the sporadic rhythms of modern life. And do it. You know, some people just get into it and go. I enjoy just spending a time with one paragraph at times. Mm-hmm. And so I just urge you, I call it a Bible, and I think like a Bible, you can pick it up, open it up, and read a paragraph if that helps you there. But I do urge everyone to give the entire novel a try. It's well worth the effort.
Nathaniel Philbrick, he's the author of Why Read Moby Dick, joined us today from the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket Island, off the coast of Massachusetts. And Mr. Philbrick, thank you very much for the time.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Tim Slover, the show directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.